you know, put it very bluntly, I mean, we'd rather have the Americans sit on the oil spigot than the Chinese. There's no question. I mean, there was a time when we were very anti-American. But I think today, given our contradictions with China, which have sharpened, that we would rather see the U.S. remain a major player in the Gulf, and I think and in the Middle East as a whole, that suits our larger Indo-Pacific strategy as well, because there we need the U.S. might to be able to produce a stable balance of power system in the East. And I think the same thing.
Welcome to the China MENA podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. When we talk about extra-regional powers in the Middle East, we tend to focus on the U.S. and China, but don't take your eye off of India. With historically long religious, cultural, and economic ties, India has always had a deep presence in the region. In recent years, however, this has taken a more strategic turn, as New Delhi has been engaging across political, diplomatic, and security issues as well. To tell us more about India's footprint in the Middle East and the larger geopolitical consequences, I'm delighted to be joined by C. Raja Mohan. Raja is a senior fellow with the Asia Society Policy Institute in Delhi, a division of the Asia Policy Center in Mumbai. He's a visiting research professor at the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore, where he previously was the director. Raja, thanks so much for joining us.
Wonderful being with you.
Okay, so Raja, can we start with a brief overview of what India's interests in the Middle East are? How have they changed in recent years? And are there any countries in particular that are more strategically important to India?
Look, I think as you mentioned in your initial remarks, India's had a very close link with the Arabian Peninsula, with Iran, and the further in Levant and North Africa. So it's a long-standing relationship that has been there. Three things have changed, I would say, in the last 40, 50 years. One, India is a major importer of energy. So therefore, India's dependence, almost 90% of imported energy. So therefore, what we saw happen from the 70s was a dramatic surge in oil imports, as well as the value and the cost of those imports. This, has remains a major challenge for India, that because India inflation sensitive and inflation is sensitive to energy prices. So therefore, what happens in the Gulf has a direct bearing on the Indian economy. The second factor, I think this was partly compensated by the fact that India exported large number of working people into the Gulf. Today, there are close to 8 million Indians living in the Gulf alone. I'm not talking the whole of the Middle East, in the Gulf alone. And the remittances they send home are partly compensate for the high price we pay for the oil. So in a way, while India pays for the oil, India also benefits from the construction and the economic activity because the Indians are quite a key component of the labor market in the Gulf. A third aspect has been, which has been less understood, because India historically had a historically a security role in the Gulf under the British Raj, that much of the security of the Gulf and the Arabian Sea and the northwestern quadrant of the Indian Ocean was done from Bombay. But Nehru deliberately withdrew from that role. But as we discovered over the last 40 years, I mean, the security of the Arabian Peninsula and India are deeply interdependent. That radical ideas that emerged out of the Arabian Peninsula have had a great effect on the subcontinent. The forces of violent religious extremism have encouraged a whole lot of new thinking in the subcontinent, partly accelerated by the Afghan jihad, Pakistan's adoption of Islamic instruments. So this produced a layer to the conflict naturally existed between India and Pakistan. So therefore, the impact of the Gulf politics, ideas about religion and politics, religion and society, have a deep impact on South Asia. So combating violent religious extremism or terrorism is a main challenge for India. And there, I think what we've seen happen is really the beginnings of an expansive cooperation with the moderate Gulf Arab states, which includes UAE, Saudi Arabia. As we speak, the president of Egypt, El-Sisi, is in India. Terrorism, extremism are at the top of the conversation between Mr. Modi and Mr. El-Sisi. And I think what we're seeing is that the India in the past was so focused on supporting Arab nationalism against West and Israel. But today is actually working with the moderate Gulf states, which are today engage Israel themselves. So that contradiction is no longer there. Second, I think they're also close partners for India in battling religious extremism. And finally, the economic links between the subcontinent, between India and the Gulf, mainly through the UAE and Saudi Arabia, are growing rapidly. And India hopes that the Gulf capital, which has grown in large volumes, will play a big role in India's acceleration of India's economic growth. So I would say at this point, the moderate Arab states are major partners. And over the last few decades, India has also built up a good relationship with Israel. And now we have the I2U2, India, Israel, Emirates, and the United States. It's interesting that these were the three forces we tried to keep away from the United States, away from Israel, and away from the Gulf Arabs. Today, I think they're also close partners. And luckily for us, they work closely with Egypt. They work closely with Israel. So I think we are in a very, very different framework in dealing with the Middle East.
That's a really great overview. One of the points you brought up, I think, is really important, that there are 8 million plus Indian residents in the Gulf alone. That really complicates or gives more depth, I guess, to the strategic side of things, or the defense side of things, when Indian leaders have to think about the Gulf. Security or insecurity here has a deep impact, I'm sure, on the domestic political narratives within India itself. I'm sure everybody in India has family here. Everybody here has family back in India. It's a very deep enmeshment, I'd say.
Yeah, it's a huge, as you rightly said, it's an opportunity as well as a danger. When Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, India had to evacuate thousands of Indians from the war theater. And later, when things were happening in Libya in 2016, if I recall right, India had to evacuate close to 30,000 Indians from Libya. Mm. So I think the presence of such a large number of Indians also has increased responsibility on India for their security, for their welfare. So in a way, the use of Indian Army, which Nehru shunned in the post-independence years, today, Indian security forces become critical for evacuating in crisis. And increasingly, also work with the Gulf countries to improve the life and improve the life of the Indian workers in the Gulf. Giving them better rights, giving them better insurance, a whole range of factors. Because unlike the previous governments, Mr. Modi is deeply committed to the welfare of the Indian diaspora. So I think that brings it a whole new dimension, where he's taken it up directly, and I think he's had some success with the UAE, with Saudi Arabia, which are the two largest hosts of Indian population, to respond more positively to the concerns of the Indian workers.
Oh yeah, well, here in Abu Dhabi, we see it. I mean, they're building an Indian temple here. The Indian community is acknowledged as being a really important pillar of the society here. I think something like 40% of the UAE is South Asian. So that interdependence works both ways, I would say. You mentioned a lot about the Gulf, and I think it's really interesting for me, living here in the UAE and focusing a lot on Gulf international politics. There's been a bit of a shift for India, as the GCC's become more important, and it's kind of backed away from Iran, which traditionally has been a little closer to India, at least in strategic affairs. Is this about the economic opportunity? Is it about, like you described, the population shift, where there's so many Indian residents living in the GCC countries? Or is there a larger geopolitical logic at play as well?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of talk about India's partnership with Iran, but it doesn't get anywhere, because Iran is locked in a confrontation with its neighbors, and it's locked in a confrontation with the US and the West. So while Iran is important for India, surely because it has a huge border with Pakistan and Afghanistan, and it also provides access to India, to Central Asia. So therefore, from a long-term geopolitical perspective, Iran is important. Its location, its population, all make it important. But right now, there is not very much we can do with Iran. There was some coordination with them during the when the Taliban was in power. Hopefully, there'll be more today again. But the 8 million people, the remittances, the oil we get from the Gulf, I mean, you know, is way, way above what we do with Iran. And while ideally we would like to do business with Iran, I mean, it's constrained, as I said, the limits to what we can do with them. So I think Iran, the talk is more than the actual action. While the Gulf, I think in the past, we tended to look at it very in a mercantilist fashion, merely looking at oil and the export of labor. One of the things Mr. Modi has changed is really to take a more strategic view of the Gulf, that we can do things with them. And I think we're beginning to get a recognition that the kind of capital, what some of the scholars in the Gulf have called the Khaliji capital, the volumes of Khaliji capital are so large that actually for an India that's looking for capital for its own growth, it's going to be, the Gulf is going to be a great partner. And my sense is we're just beginning to explore those possibilities. And you'll see a lot more of that happen. We've just signed an FTA with the UAE, as you know. Hopefully we can do something similar with the GCC as a whole. And a little more difficult would be, while there are talks about India playing a security role, that I think we'll have to work out in greater detail of how we do this in the days ahead. I think one of the problems with the focus on the Gulf in the last few years has been we tended to neglect the western part of the Arab world. Our relationship with Israel have dramatically improved under Mr. Modi. But the western part of the Levant, the North Africa, Egypt were neglected. And I think I would see El-Sisi's visit really as a way of getting back to Egypt, because Egypt was a great partner in the 50s and the 60s. So in some senses, we're getting back to, because it's Egypt that has the heft, large population, large standing army, and its pivotal position in the region. So for us, getting back to Egypt brings back some balance into a policy which is not just limited to the Gulf.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because that leads into, you know, my next question. You mentioned, you know, India's rising presence in the Levant, and I was in Israel recently, and there was a lot of talk about Israel-India ties. Pretty much everybody I spoke with were becoming, you know, kind of expert on India very quickly, because they were realizing that things have changed pretty dramatically. Especially over the past year with this I2U2 that you mentioned, this configuration of the two I's of Israel and India and the two U's of the UAE and the US. So I'm still surprised. It doesn't get as much notice here as I thought it would. I'm not sure how people in other places are thinking about it. So could you give our listeners just a quick description of what I2U2 is, and how have the Abraham Accords reconfigured India's approach to the Middle East?
Yeah, I think for us, for India, given its championship of the Arab nationalism and its support for Palestinians in the past, there was a problem of how do we normalize relationship with Israel while at the same time keeping up our traditional positions in the Arab world. And I think the Abraham Accords have actually made it easier for us to don't have to constantly look over our shoulders. So I think that opened a lot of space for India to work with Israel and the Gulf Arabs at the same time. The I2U2 at this point, I mean, I think it's still really the beginnings of a major project. The initial focus is on economic issues. But I think the question, how soon would it acquire a strategic character? So I would say, look, it'll take some more time. It's better to build this slowly strongly rather than rushing into grand security structures at this point. But the idea was to have the US as part of this and get India, UAE, and Israel to do a lot more things. So they just, I think we're at the beginning of a process.
Yeah, and I think it's been pretty interesting to watch at this stage because, like you say, the focus, I think, has been very careful, focusing on issues like food security, on development, on technology, you know, things that everybody needs more of, and kind of keeping the geopolitics out of it. But, of course, geopolitics is a big part of what we talk about on this show, and I think it's kind of hard to not think about what those consequences might be. I mean, I think the I2U2 members have been really good at framing it as a geoeconomic initiative, and it's not balancing against Iran. It's not balancing against China. There's no balancing. It's meant to be inclusive. But I imagine the view from Beijing is pretty different. I think they probably see this and associate with other Indo-Pacific mini-laterals like the Quad or AUKUS, and this seems to be yet another U.S.-centered approach to limiting Chinese gains in the region. So I imagine in Beijing, it's probably not perceived as an entirely positive development. How are people in New Delhi thinking about the India-U.S.-China triangle in the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, put it very bluntly, I mean, we'd rather have the Americans sit on the oil spigot than the Chinese. There's no question. I mean, there was a time when we were very anti-American. But I think today, given our contradictions with China, which have sharpened, that we would rather see the U.S. remain a major player in the Gulf, and I think and in the Middle East as a whole, that suits our larger Indo-Pacific strategy as well, because there we need the U.S. might to be able to produce a stable balance of power system in the East. And I think the same thing applies to the West. Unfortunately, the Biden administration's initial mistakes in the Middle East of framing, too much of this democracy versus autocracy business. It's by targeting so much fire at Mohammed bin Salman, they've created problems for themselves and compelled, I think, the region to diversify away from the U.S. But hopefully, this is not a permanent rupture and that the U.S. would come back to be a part of the security structure and remain an important part of the security structure, because there's too much talk about U.S. pivoting away or U.S. burning its bridges with the Gulf. But I think both sides will need each other. And for us, as we build our capabilities, we'd rather have the Americans for as long as we can rather than Americans leave, and we are not in a position to fill that vacuum. So I don't think there are any illusions in Delhi that if the U.S. leaves, we can simply step in. So for us, I think to work with the U.S., with France, with Britain, wherever possible, to be able to have a structure there that is not left to Russia and China to simply walk all over. But my sense is I hope that the Bush and Biden administration will begin to make the adjustments necessary to make sure that there's no geopolitical vacuum out there.
Yeah, I think that's really accurate. I also think that they kind of have gotten their feet under them a little bit in the region in the past few months. You know, you saw everybody focused on the Biden trip to Saudi and the negative imagery that came of that, or even the negative consequences of it. But his trip to Israel, they signed this strategic dialogue on technology cooperation. They're really showing that commitment. We saw recently this $100 billion development project with the UAE on clean energy. You saw them talking to Turkey just last week. And then in December, there's a report about how the U.S. has been working with China, or sorry, with Saudi, to help them develop their national security strategy. So it does seem that they've, got some success that they're building on. And like you say, I think that's really good for countries like India, like the UK, like France, and Asian allies and partners that rely on this kind of U.S. security structure that allows these countries to have, their interests in the region met with a pretty low security cost.
Absolutely. Because I think the depth of the ties between U.S. and the, and to say, let's put more bluntly, the Anglo-American world and the Gulf is so deep that it'll be, it's not easy or wise for either side to simply walk away. But as you know, in Washington, you're right in the Beltway. I mean, there are always ideological groups seeking, you know, grand solutions, but I think common sense will come back, because the scale of interest, because it looked like Gulf oil did not matter when the Biden administration took charge. A year later, it's so central to the world of energy security, of dealing with the consequences of the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. Just that recognition that sure, the U.S. isn't reliant on Gulf energy, but everybody's affected by, you know, energy pricing. And of course, Gulf countries have a major role in this, right? So I think they've realized that they have to be involved here politically, and that might require them to maybe swallow some things politically that they weren't willing to maybe this time last year, especially like you mentioned, the relations with Saudi, but I think it has been shifting. It's also interesting too, because like we were just saying with I2U2, with the Quad, you know, as you described, India has really reconsidered how it approaches its relations with the U.S. a lot this century. This show, of course, we talk a lot about China, and I always see China as kind of an animating factor in that the strategic landscape in Asia has really changed with China becoming much more active throughout Asia. But for India especially, I mean, I think of what China's been doing throughout South Asia, you know, with CPEC, with, you know, its BRI projects in all of the smaller South Asian states. So it really does seem for India, it's a pretty difficult balancing act to consider how to, you know, cooperate with the U.S. without antagonizing China overtly. You know, how do you see this India-China relationship right now?
No, we have had a pretty rough relationship with China. We've had a series of military crises on the border in 2013, 2014, 2017, 2020. So this idea that India should not, you know, get closer to the U.S. because China will get upset, that has been a powerful argument because of India's historic non-alignment, Asian solidarity, multipolarity, these kind of goals. I mean, it was a very deeply held view. But I think we should really thank Xi Jinping for pushing India to the other side, that whatever the ambivalences that India has had, I think Chinese military assertiveness in the last decade in the Himalayas has really compelled India to take a fresh look. So I don't think there are any illusions of the kind that Mr. Nehru started with, that China is a natural partner for India in building a new order in Asia and in the international system. Those illusions are no longer there. I mean, that it's quite clear that we need the US, we need the West to deal with the China's China challenge. But at the same time, it's a fact that China's power has grown, dramatically grown on the economic front. And its power is being projected into the Indian Ocean. And the first military base abroad is in Djibouti, right next to the Gulf. And probably they'll be looking around for new places to acquire a permanent military presence. So it's no longer a question of whether, but it is a question of when. Notwithstanding the current crisis in East China Sea and the South China Sea, I don't think China is going to give up its two-ocean strategy, that it will continue to project power into the Indian Ocean. And I think for India, this is really, so our problem is not just in the Himalayas, but also in the south, in the waters of the Indian Ocean. And the fact that China has cultivated special relationships with the key island states like Sri Lanka, Maldives, Mauritius, Seychelles, I think the Chinese presence has grown. So this is really a long-term challenge for India. And that again, I think, makes it clear that India has to work with the Western partners. And that's why the Quad is so focused on maritime security issues and on doing a range of things to secure the ocean spaces from being, you know, Chinese taking a much larger role in this part of the world. So that, I think, is set now. It is both in the Himalayas as well as in the Indian Ocean. India's problems with China are only going to rise. And for all the talk about Xi Jinping's charm diplomacy, we haven't seen much in relation to India. They're doing a lot of sweet talk to the U.S. finance capital in Davos. But with Japan, where they have a massive territorial dispute, or with India, there is no sign of any easing up of the pressures. So I don't see Xi Jinping giving up on on the territorial questions, where they think it is their right to unilaterally change the borders. So I think our problems with China are only going to grow. While the US, there are sections which will continue to argue, look, there is room for guardrails, there's room for collaboration. All that is fine. But my sense is, for India, the contradiction with China will be the principal contradiction for the next three decades and more, coming decades. And addressing that, any answer that we produce to will necessarily involve the US and its allies, in, not only in Asia, but also in Europe.
Mm. So, yeah, there's a lot of really great stuff in that. But one thing that I kept thinking about while you were describing this is, you know, this China-Iran relationship, which seems very troubling to folks in Washington. And I always caution, you know, just by looking at the numbers and saying, I don't think that China's engagement with Iran is really as deep as it's often portrayed. I'm often asked to explain how, you know, China can have this good relationship with Iran and also have this good relationship with the Saudis and the Emiratis. And I think that a lot of folks seem to think that when China and Iran announced this strategic partnership or comprehensive strategic partnership, that it would somehow alter the balance of power in the Gulf. And I didn't think that was the case at all. But I did think it did alter, or it has the potential to alter, the balance of power in South Asia. You know, I thought that a deeper China-Iran relationship probably isn't going to mean much to Saudi in the big picture. But for India, it actually could be problematic. Do you agree with that assessment, or do you think that it's not really a big deal in South Asia either?
You are right. And I think we should also see this as part of a growing Sino-Russian partnership. Mm-hmm. That is, they've been enticing Pakistan. I mean, in fact, the fact that Pakistan's Prime Minister, then Prime Minister Imran Khan, showed up on February 23rd in Moscow just before Putin was ordering the invasion. A lot of people thought, at least in Delhi, the speculation was that the Chinese encouraged him to go to Moscow. So this idea that, Russia, China can draw in other, you know, partners in the greater Middle East to shore up their alliance, and both Pakistan and Iran are natural partners there. But Pakistan still has a lot of links with the UK and the US, so I don't see them, while they are very close to China, whether they will actually be allowed, you know. They're trying to, I think, make some adjustments. The army now, after Imran Khan, you know, resetting the relationship with the US, trying to reset the relationship with the US. With Iran, you know, it's always a difficult partner for anyone. I mean, they're not easy to deal with. So it's not that the Chinese, just because they signed a declaration, it's automatically going to translate into something, you know, immediate outcome. They might be able to build a relationship over the period. And that will certainly, and if Russia and China do it together, it'll certainly could become a problem for India. And the fact is that Iran, if, you know, unlike Saudi Arabia today or UAE, which are taking a more moderate position, which are doing social reform internally, we don't see Iran actually cracking down on what, against the women, against the various forces. So I think that's also going to be a problem for us. Though ideally for us, an Iran that's at peace with the West would provide us a lot of opportunities, but that's not in our hands to produce.
Yeah, there's just so many moving parts here, right? And, you know, when you're talking about maritime security as being such an important consideration in the Indian Ocean region, I was thinking about Gwadar and how much China's, you know, put into this port in Pakistan, and also thinking just up the coastline a bit in Chabahar, and how India's been, you know, wanting to work on this for forever, and starts making headway, and then something happens in Iran, or something happens with the Iran-US relationship, and it just keeps getting harder. But we saw a couple of years ago some Iranian officials talking about, you know, how they're very happy to engage much more closely with China on developing Chabahar. I think that would really change the maritime landscape for India if China were, you know, investing deeply into that port, investing into Gwadar, becoming a resident actor in a lot of other Indian Ocean ports. This could really be an issue for India. Yeah.
No. Absolutely. I think we did build a terminal in Chabahar, one terminal, but you know, Iranians are not a classical trading nation of the type that the Gulf Arabs are. So the structure of their economy, the nature of their politics continue to prevent where they have the natural gateway to the to Inner Asia, but getting that, translating that beautiful line on the map into an operational corridor will be quite hard, and I think that's a part of the problem. So and then the if the Chinese do make a major presence in Iran, in Chabahar, and to build a military relationship, and I think that's why it's important for India to step up on the security partnership with the Gulf Arabs. We need to do a lot more with them. Look for alternative routes. I mean, I think there are some people have suggested we could work through UAE, Israel, Greece, use routes into the Mediterranean rather than being fixated simply on cutting through Iran into the north, because it doesn't look like the regime is changing on its own volition or is going to be forced out, because if Iran remains a bloc, its growing compulsion to align with Russia and China will grow, and that will be a problem, a serious problem for India.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to watch. I've been based in the Emirates now since 2006, and I've been watching this stuff for quite a while. And there's a point, maybe I guess in 2015, when there was so much talk about, or 2016, when all this talk about CPEC, and I thought, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, it just seemed natural to me. I thought you'd see a lot more investment from the Saudis, from the Emiratis going into it. And I talked to a Pakistani official, and he said, actually, we haven't really seen the money from the Gulf that we were hoping for. And he said, well, I kind of blame their closer economic engagement with India. And it just seemed to me a really fascinating kind of rectangle where, historically the GCC and Pakistan lined up pretty neatly, and Iran and India lined up pretty neatly, and that kind of explained things. And just in the past few years, it doesn't anymore. And you just look at how those two very intense rivalries that spans across these, the Gulf and South Asia, really does make for a very interesting geopolitical chessboard here.
No, absolutely. If you take a longer view, when, in fact, Iran and Pakistan and Turkey were part of the CENTO, then, Iraq left the Baghdad Pact. So we were closer to Iraq at that point. India was closer to the Baathists, the guys in the pinstripes, while the Turks, the Pakistanis, it was the Pakistanis who joined an anti-Arab alliance. While India was actually, championing the Arab cause, it was Pakistan, that was the UK that sponsored CENTO, but it didn't last too long. And later, in the post-70s, we saw the Gulf Arabs come much closer to Pakistan, and India tending to take a very negative view, and I think took a unidimensional view of the Gulf Arabs. And I don't think we fully understood their problems post-79. Three major things, happened in 79. You had the Russian intervention in Afghanistan at the end of it, Iranian revolution, the attack on the Grand Mosque in Mecca, as well as the Israel-Egypt peace treaty. So in a way, 79 dramatically altered the structure of geopolitics in the Middle East. And I think our Russia connection and our problems with Pakistan and the rise of Islamic terrorism, I think, made us lose our way in terms of how we deal with the Arabian Peninsula, which was historically been close to us. But I think we've overcome those hurdles today. I think India does not view the Arabia through the lens of Pakistan or the lens of Islam. In fact, it's very interesting that Mr. MBZ and MBS are the closest friends Mr. Modi has in the Middle East. So I think we are in a new situation, and I think there's a lot more sophistication today in terms of how India thinks about it. It's not because Indian economy is, for example, 10 times larger than Pakistan's. So the Gulf capital sees a lot more opportunities in India. And for Pakistan, it becomes someone always seeking money to bail them out rather than it's not an investment opportunity. So I think those equations have changed. And Iran, which was very close to the West, is on the other camp today. But for India, I think the real prospect is the convergences with the Arab Gulf, with the moderates, with the West have significantly increased, and with Israel. That's where I think if we keep building up this relationship, we should be able to counter any potential negative developments that could take place in Iran.
It's funny, while you're describing this, I was just thinking, I took my family on a vacation to Kerala, you know, in 2017, and we were driving across the province and it was beautiful, but I kept seeing these large banners with pictures of different sheikhs from Saudi and from the UAE. And when I asked the locals, why so many? They're like, oh, there's so much investment that is poured in from Dubai, from Riyadh, from Abu Dhabi into this province. It really just kind of hit home, the deep interdependence between, you know, India and the UAE, India and Saudi.
It's interesting. I mean, the whole diplomacy, that those always came from, you know, the Trucial States to Indian West Coast. And after 73, we saw a dramatic expansion of Indian labor exports. And Kerala was one major source of those, a source of those exports. So in a sense, Kerala has a very, very special connection to the Gulf, and you see them everywhere. Though it's a tiny state by Indian standards, I mean, its presence in the Gulf is huge. But my sense is today the connections are much wider in many other parts of India. And again, I mean, I think the Gulf capital, what it can do to India's real estate, construction, telecom sectors is immense. And space, for example, UAE has been very keen to develop space cooperation with India. So I think we are looking at a whole range of possibilities in a way that is positive, while the story with Iran is always a negative one. Okay, how do we deal with the Taliban, or how do we, you know, contain Pakistan's support for crazy forces in Taliban in Afghanistan? But I think the economic dimension with the Gulf Arabs is huge. And as Gulf opens up, becomes more moderate politically, and modernizes socially, the connections between India and the Arab Gulf will only deepen. So I would say this is really, we just at the beginning of, shall we say, the whole line of a really beautiful relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really fascinating time to watch this stuff. Before I moved to the Gulf, I'd spent, you know, most of my 20s living in East Asia. And when I came here, I had this in my mind, you know, I was going to a different place. I was going from Asia to the Middle East. And then, you know, having been here so long, I think of the Gulf as, you know, rather than the easternmost limits of the Middle East, I think of it as more of the westernmost limits of this bigger Asia. And, you know, you just see so much happening here in that space. You know, I had a group of students from the U.S. visit our campus last semester, and they were saying, like, wow, this is a really kind of westernized place. They were in Dubai, and I was like, this is very Asian. Look around. Everybody you see is from India, or they're from Sri Lanka, or they're from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And it really is this kind of Asianization process, which the way you're describing, like all these opportunities and economic engagement and space and tourism, you know, you can see a lot of this stuff happening all the time, this really positive narrative, which, you know, frankly, in the West, we don't hear very many positive narratives about the Middle East. It's usually a problem to be solved. And that's just not the way it's kind of described. You know, this is late January that we're recording this. Just last week, the South Korean president was here in town. They're talking about cooperation on nuclear, on defense, on security, on any number of things. It really is. You're seeing a lot of these linkages between Asian countries and societies and these Gulf ones or Middle Eastern ones really intensifying in a very interesting way.
Absolutely. And I think I see even, you know, many people from the Gulf who land up in Singapore used to say, oh, we are in Asia. The notion, you know, that Middle East and Asia were different, well, partly, yeah. I think the colonial era way these divisions were identified in the foreign offices of the West, Near East, Far East, Middle East. I think those divisions are breaking down, I think, because East Asia is an economic dynamo. West Asia, I mean, say, has all the energy resources, has the capital now to transform the region. And then we see the integration of North Africa, the Horn of Africa. I think you see this fusing of East and West Asia. We had this talk about, you know, Nehru in the 40s talking about Asia. We said, look, West Asia, East Asia, but it had no economic component at the time. It was really a political idea. Right. Today, it is being driven by economics, by commerce, by movement of labor, capital. This is where I think the real connections get established, And my sense is there'll be more and more of this, where the Gulf capital contributes to the growth of the rest of the region, while the movement of people into these countries for labor and for other purposes will also grow. So I think we're going to see Asianization of Asia in a sense.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. But I also am somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about geopolitics. And, you know, while I love these positive stories, the cultural, my students who are fascinated by South Korean, you know, cultural products and Japanese manga and Indian, you know, Bollywood film. But I kind of also see the dark cloud on the horizon too. And I do see there's a lot of tensions geopolitically across Asia, which often don't feature, you know, in this broader narrative of the Asian century, you know, nothing but bright skies ahead, economic growth, focus on FTAs. Do you see, like me, I know you think about geopolitics a lot, do you see the potential for these Asian tensions that are kind of beneath the surface spilling out into the Gulf in a way that folks here haven't had to think about very much yet?
Yeah, I think the Asian century was always a simplistic idea. I mean, it's really still the colonial, post-colonial argument. I mean, if you think of the European century or European centuries, it was full of conflict, right? I mean, European story was also about inter-European conflict, both within the continent as well as for the colonies outside. So I think the myth of, that Asia is one has been broken because of China's own assertiveness. And its attempt to alter territorial status quo across the region. But I think, as I said, for the commerce, I mean, it is producing new connections. I mean, both the movement of capital and labor producing new connections. And I think this, over the longer term, we still need a security architecture. It can't just be built on ideas of Asian century or Asian unity, because even after, say, 400 years after Europe's rise, it still doesn't have a security architecture, as we discovered last year, that the notion that Europe has transcended geopolitics, I mean, has turned out to be utterly false. So similarly in Asia, I mean, I think we have a long way to go. But I think if we can build on the positive forces, and it's again, it can't be something exclusive, that it should not be that Asia, you know, for a long time, this framing, Asia versus the West, East versus the West, a lot of it really was self-defeating, because I think we need the West, Western powers, if you will, I mean, and to be able to stabilize this region, and Asia will increasingly contribute to the West as well. So I think the if we can keep backing up the positive forces in the region, while keeping in check the negative forces, those who want to establish hegemony. But there's Iran trying to establish hegemony in the Gulf in the name of religion, or the Chinese trying to do it in the name of their great China dream. Then I think the positive story can be expanded, I would say.
That, to me, is a perfect note to end on. You know, we're ending with something positive that doesn't come up much on shows like this, where we're talking about a lot of Middle Eastern geopolitics. So thank you. Raja, I always enjoy talking politics with you. I always learn a lot from it, from your perspective. I mean, you've been based in so many fascinating places. You know everybody. You've really looked at this from a lot of angles. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. It was wonderful speaking to you today, Jonathan.
Okay, and hopefully I'll see you either here in Abu Dhabi soon or in India. To our listeners, thanks for joining us again. Please check us out on our YouTube channel, or like and rate and subscribe and all that stuff on Stitcher, Spotify, and iTunes and all those great venues. And we'll see you next month. Thank you.
Produced by Heartcast Media.